Okay, well, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. We're about to begin our briefing today, but first, if you haven't already signed in, please do that, because we'd like to send you an audio recording of the briefing and other materials, all the presentation materials, and we can't do that unless you tell us how to reach you. So right outside, there's a sign-in sheet that you can get to if you didn't as you leave. Today's briefing is on Great Lakes Regional Infrastructure, Addressing Barriers to Implementation. I'm Michael Goff, president of the Northeast Midwest Institute, and we're pleased to be your co-host today, along with the Great Lakes Commission, our great partners, as they launch their report on green infrastructure in the Great Lakes region. With the whole region facing growing stormwater management challenges, the Great Lakes Commission's report is a significant and actually very timely document, and one that's going to be very valuable in guiding the region and its local communities in developing green infrastructure in the years ahead. As you know, federal, state, and provincial policy has a huge impact on local community responses with new green infrastructure. Today's briefing is going to shed some light on this dynamic and help the Great Lakes region to continue to progress in implementing sound green infrastructure practices. So we look forward to sharing a lot with you. We have a great panel, and Dr. Sri Vidyachalam, who's director of the Safe Drinking Water Program at the Northeast Midwest Institute, is going to moderate the panel, and he'll introduce our great group of speakers. So, Sri.
Thanks, Michael. We have with us four speakers, and we expect two members of Congress to also address this event. They'll join us sometime in the middle. So we'll start with Victoria Pebbles. She's a program director with the Great Lakes Commission, where her work addresses complex ecological and related socioeconomic issues, including clean energy, climate change, water resource management, habitat conservation, land use, and coastal management. Before joining the commission, she held positions with the University of Michigan, U.S. Senate, and the U.S. EPA. She'll talk about the newly issued report, which was released yesterday and is also available outside for readers. So, Victoria, why don't you start?
The mic is distracting me.
Now that I've navigated that infrastructure, we can talk about green infrastructure. Welcome, everyone. I'm happy to see a few familiar faces and to hear to talk about. The report actually went out today, so this is hot off the press, and we timed it to just build up some momentum. So that I work at the Great Lakes Commission, just by way of background. We're a coalition of the eight states and two provinces that border the Great Lakes. We were founded by an interstate compact, a legally binding document and ratified by the U.S. Senate. In the 1950s, and so the eight states are our members, and the two provinces are associate members, and we're very closely with federal partners, local partners, and NGO community and other partners, many those who are at the table with me today, on a variety of issues facing our Great Lakes region. So I'm going to talk a little bit about green infrastructure. So, hopefully
That's just the obvious.
Okay. That's the audio.
Yeah, we can just keep.
So what is it? It's a variety of stormwater management, really. So green infrastructure can be used for a number of purposes. Some people use it for pollinator habitat, or they might use it for carbon sequestration or other things. But really, in our region, we're facing growing issues related to managing stormwater. That's the water that runs off rooftops and roads and parking lots in urban areas, and sometimes farms and fields in rural areas. So when we talk about green infrastructure, we're talking about really using nature-based solutions. They can be large scale, like wetlands and forests, or they can be smaller scale, site-specific things like a rain garden or a bioswale. The idea is that you imitate nature, you create an opportunity for water to rather than just shed off the surface of the land and go right into the nearby water. The water actually can percolate below the surface, and so. Why is it important? Well, because when you don't, when you stop that water from infiltrating, it can back up in basements. It can cause flooding for streets. It can keep kids from being able to cross the street and go to school. Elderly people from being able to get out or to their housing. It can also cause public health issues if those backups are actually from sewage, which sometimes happens too. So then not only do you have a volumetric or a volume of water problem, you now have a public health crisis on your hand. So most of the implementation of these types of solutions are done at the local level, and I'm really happy to have John Diggert with the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative talk from the local perspective. But that's not to say that the federal government and the state governments don't also have a really important role to either create conditions that can enable local governments to do green infrastructure easier, faster, better, or they can create policies sometimes directly or indirectly that can hinder these practices. So why else is it important? I talked about controlling volume. That's the big issue that we're looking at in the Great Lakes region, as well as the quality of water. But there are a lot of different kinds of other benefits. Some people call them co-benefits or ancillary benefits. And you can bucket them into like environmental benefits, social benefits, and economic benefits. And depending on the type of green infrastructure that you're looking at, you might get all of those that are on the list on this slide here. But not all of them offer that. So, for example, permeable pavers doesn't necessarily do a whole lot for food security, but bioswales or urban forests might. So this policy analysis came out of a two-year project funded by the Herb Family Foundation to create a mentoring network where we're putting peers in touch with peers, champions, people who have done green infrastructure in touch with those who haven't done green infrastructure, and actually just doing a matchmaking and letting this mentoring network grow. And we also were looking at competitive mini-grants to help foster those mentoring relationships and do projects. The policy piece was a unique add-on to this, and so we just completed it. Our partner to do the analysis on the Canadian side was the Credit Valley Conservation Authority. They're based in Mississauga near Toronto. And so the full report, if you read it, actually has recommendations related to provincial policy and Canadian federal policy as well. But today I'm really just going to talk about the U.S. federal side because we're here on the Hill. So I mentioned that. That's just a map of our Great Lakes Basin. So it's about 300,000 square miles. 200,000 of those are about 200,000 square miles is land. About a little less than 100,000 is water. So we're talking about a really large area that drains into these Great Lakes. So just by way of context, so looking at what does the federal government, what is their role, we have kind of two basic large buckets of how we manage stormwater at the federal level. We have combined systems. This is when you have storm sewers and sanitary sewers that actually combine. And when you have heavy rainfall events, these systems can get overwhelmed and it can release untreated sewage water into receiving waters. And we've actually had quite a bit of that over the past few years that has come into the Great Lakes region, and it's not a pretty sight. So right now, the way that that's done in through federal policy, there are nine minimum controls under these CSS policies at the federal level, but none of them require the control of volume. So they really don't address the issues that we're talking about here, which is too much water in one place at the same time. On the other side, some communities actually have those sanitary and storm sewers separated. There's a long word called MS4 for short. And they also have, there's a regulatory framework that have permits under the Clean Water Act. And those permits do include a post-construction runoff control that includes best management practices, but those best management practices may or may not be green infrastructure. So all this is to say there's a framework out there, but it's not really a policy that incents or encourages green infrastructure. And that's what our report is really trying to do, is look at what's the federal role in making this stronger. And then finally, what we have, and we see more often than anything, if you look at a lot of the green infrastructure being put in the ground around the Great Lakes region, quite a bit of it is being done because of a consent decree. So these come into play, unfortunately, after there's a violation. We've already had a major problem, and now there has to be an order that is negotiated between the EPA and the community. Judges get involved, orders are signed, and it's forced upon them after a problem. Seems a little reactionary to do this. So we're going to talk about more proactive approaches in a minute. But this is what they do right now. This is the one mechanism, federal mechanism, that actually can compel a wastewater treatment plant to consider it. Right? So it doesn't even compel them to actually implement it. So some of them are descriptive and some are prescriptive. Sometimes they are prescriptive where they do require, but not all consent decrees require green infrastructure. For example, this picture here below is a picture of the Northeast Ohio Regional Sewerage District, and they were required under their consent decree to spend $42 million. They had to spend it on green infrastructure as part of their remedy and to control 44 million gallons of wet weather water per year through their green infrastructure. So in this way, even though they're kind of reactionary, these consent decrees, they do tend to foster innovation. We're seeing a lot of that with these where it is prescribed within these consent decrees. But often the studies are showing that doing this after the fact, after there's a problem, it's more costly and, again, reactive. So as I mentioned, a key takeaway here is that currently the only real federal enforceable mechanism for green infrastructure is through consent decrees. So there's a key opportunity here through the Clean Water Act, and particularly with the State Revolving Fund. Many of you are familiar with these. It's a very critical source of funding for water infrastructure nationwide. There are about 20% of the SRF funds that are earmarked for sustainability, but not those funds don't always go to the Green Project Reserve. In fact, the recent studies show that about 4% only of all SRF money goes to green infrastructure. And there's a variety of reasons for this. Sometimes there's just not enough SRF money to pay for improving the pumps and the pipes, the gray infrastructure that's already in the ground. Sometimes communities don't have a way to leverage other money to maintain and operate systems once they're installed because O&M isn't part of the funding. And there's other logistical barriers. So where we look at these gaps, we're trying to say where are these, what are these gaps, and I've identified a few of those, and how can we work to help fill these gaps. So recognizing that consent decrees are reactive and can be costly, that funding isn't being utilized as well as it might be for these complementary systems, these green systems that can complement gray systems. And there's limited ability to support technical. There's not as much workforce training, people that actually know how to maintain a bioswale. A civil engineer knows how to maybe go fix a pump or a pipe, but who's trained to go out there and fix a bioswale if the filter breaks or somebody mows over the plants? So our first recommendation is, it's not really surprising, it's not earth shattering, it's fully fund the SRF. Because if the pie is shrinking, communities are going to first say, we need to fix our pipes and our pumps. We don't have time to like look at this newer innovative approach. But there are some communities in the country, not so many in the Great Lakes region, that actually are at capacity with their pipes and pumps. So if the pie is big, then the theory here is there's adequate funding for it to be used for both improving, maintaining, and repairing the degrading gray infrastructure, as well as investing in green, complementary green solutions. Our second recommendation is about establishing performance-based requirements. We see this in a number of federal statutes. It's a common policy at the federal level. It's a minimum. You would like federal taxpayer dollars for green infrastructure? Great. We as Congress and taxpayers expect a certain amount of performance to be delivered with the use of those funds. Exactly what that performance standard is, we don't prescribe that in our report. But an example is here up on the screen is in Minnesota, for example, saying your first inch of runoff should be controlled. That's just an example so you know what we're talking about. We're not talking about a very prescriptive, you must use this technology, but rather let's demonstrate that these things are working. Our third recommendation is about more interagency coordination and promotion. So we see that there is already some interagency coordination going on being led by the US EPA, but we know that there's a lot of money that goes out through HUD, through the Department of Transportation, to build urban redevelopment projects, roads and highways, and these can also have an impact on stormwater, on flooding in our communities. So bolstering those efforts to get the agencies to work together is just a common sense idea. And I would add that there are provisions in current legislation that's being debated right now, the WERDA bill, that do seek to enhance this interagency cooperation and integration on the GI front. So those are the three federal recommendations that we have in our report. I encourage you to, if you want to read about the state recommendations, the Canadian recommendations, and more information is in the full report. It's on our website, and happy to take any other questions if you have them. Thanks.
We take questions at the end.
Okay, questions at the end.
Thank you, Victoria, for jumping through the hoops. The next speaker is Sanjeev Sinha. Dr. Sinha is director of P3 Great Lakes and a vice president at Environmental Consulting and Technology, Inc., a frequent presenter on topics related to economic instruments in the water infrastructure market. Dr. Sinha aspires to make these ideas mainstream. He manages water business services for ECT, a consulting firm that maintains 20 offices across the country. Dr. Sinha.
So, thank you very much, Jay, for the introduction. So, my work has been funded by a large number of foundations over the years. Mark Foundation being one of them, our foundation is another. Some of the work that I'll be presenting today is funded by the Great Lakes Protection Fund. And what we are looking to do is to try to see how to engage into market-based, basically engage financing that is not only federal financing. Let me actually discuss the business perspective. There were a couple slides that are missing actually from this talk. So I'm kind of starting right in the middle of my presentation. The business perspective of why is it that these are the same best management practices Victoria described earlier, just a little bit more colorful. So when we say green infrastructure, we are talking rain gardens, you know, actually trees in your backyard, greenways, biosoils, wetlands, landscaping or soil amendments, and rainwater catchment practices, fairly straightforward. So the question is, you know, why do we even bother with green stormwater infrastructure? And Victoria gave a very nice description of why we should focus on it. Let me give you a little bit of a different perspective here. Here is the government perspective. Over the next 12 years, by 2030, 42% of the U.S. landmass will be redeveloped by one entity or the other. So it provides us with a very significant market for us to actually see if we can actually do something that is a little bit different from what we have done in the past. The runoff, the amount of water that comes off of a, you know, urban area is five times when you're looking at a city block that is paved as opposed to a forest. There is also $100 billion financing gap right now between what the government is providing versus what we need. So, and as Victoria was describing, the consent decree communities or cities, there are more than 700 cities that are facing legal action by the EPA in one way or the other, and we could actually leverage that to our advantage and make infrastructure more resilient to the climate conditions and things like that. Here is the business perspective behind it. Many businesses, you know, I picked some examples because I live in Michigan. These are Michigan examples. So you have Ford Water Company. They committed to actually reducing their water usage by 72% per vehicle by 2020. Herman Miller already has his zero water footprint goals. Coca-Cola announced in 2016, 2 years ago, that they had met 100% replenishment goals for water globally, though, not in U.S. or not in one specific plant. Why are they doing that? It's because their stakeholders, people like you and me, are demanding it. It's much better storytelling, lower O&M costs, and a range of other co-benefits that Victoria went into the details of earlier. Great Lakes is an interesting area. Since Victoria has already shown the map and discussed the details, I won't go into the details of that, but here are the three challenges and drivers that I wanted to focus my talk at. First is the reduced infrastructure investments. I'll show you a slide on that. Then I'll share with you the environmental challenges, such as public health, safe drinking water. You know, communities like Detroit, you can't even drink water with a tap in the city of Detroit right now. It happened last week in the city schools. Regulatory drivers that are leading to environmental stewardship. And when you're looking at these three challenges, at the end of the day, it's all about money, as in the solutions have to be financially viable. You cannot just, you know, come out with solutions that don't seem to make any sense financially and expect it all to work out, because it won't. Here is a slide that showcases the investment gap. If you look at the data points, the curve at the top is the state and local government input in the infrastructure financing. In between 2003 and 2014, that amount dropped by 5%. The federal financing has gone down by 20%. If many of you actually look really young to me, although my scale is kind of getting skewed as I get older. But if you haven't actually, you know, if you own a home, the older the house that you have, the more you tend to spend. So it really should grow as opposed to actually shrink. So we have a problem here. We are relying on federal financing and it's not really coming in. Here are the top four environmental challenges to the Great Lakes Basin. Excessive nutrient loading. Everybody has probably read New York Times articles and Wall Street Journal, depending on your political leanings, articles on algal blooms, you know, whether it is Toledo or Saginaw Bay. Second biggest, one of the key, and they are not obviously prioritized here, but these are the four big challenges. Second challenge is climate change related meteorological patterns that are changing. In, you know, in Michigan, Keweenaw Peninsula experienced 200-year floods within a period of 10 days, twice. So a lot of damage. The third is the hydro modifications or flashiness. You can tell that I'm a civil engineer by training. The top impairment in most three or five B reports across the basin are basically hydro modifications and flashiness in the streams. And the fourth environmental challenge for the Great Lakes Basin are the invasive species. Part of the reason why I have left the first three in black is that by the use of green stormwater infrastructure, you can actually address these three, namely excessive nutrient loading, climate change related resiliency needs that you may have, and hydro modifications and flashiness. In fact, I can actually show you calculations that can tell you that there is a community, Prince George's County in Maryland, that is doing a lot of high-end community-based public-private financing. If you were to replicate the work they are doing in five communities across the Great Lakes Basin, you will never have the algal bloom in Lake Erie Basin. The problem is we don't really have a regulatory driver, so there is no hammer, and as a consequence, nothing gets done. So here are the regulatory drivers. Victoria discusses it in more detail, but I'll just give you a quick bullet point. Number one, obviously, as I mentioned earlier, we have $100 billion in unmet wet weather and stormwater needs. There are 7,500 communities across the country that are the MS4 communities. I wrote the, spelled out the acronym for you here. More than 700 combined sewer systems that have one form of consent decree or the other. And last but not the least, at the end of the day, it's all driven by people like you and me, which is growing interest in public demand for green infrastructure. So these are the challenges. Where are the opportunities? Well, here you go, guys. Here is a bar chart. The bar chart on the left tells you the traditional procurement costs. And the bar chart on the right, the column on the right, basically tells you if you do large-scale aggregation, fancy word of saying you, instead of building one house in your community, you build 200 houses, as a consequence, you have a volume savings. These numbers are from the Prince George's County Community-Based Public-Private Partnership work. The cost of constructing these projects have gone down by 35%, almost one-third drop in costs. So we have to basically find ways to look at new ways of financing and new ways of deliveries, because we really need to do more large-scale delivery as opposed to one project at a time. Market-based option, the work that we carried out, we actually published the report last year. It's really flattering to actually go to different conferences and see guys that I have a lot of respect for, Bloomberg Associates or whatever have you, quote the data from our reports. Then you know you did something worthwhile. Here are the market size for green stormwater infrastructure. In the states of Ohio, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Indiana, if you assume that one-third of the stormwater utility revenues that they have are directed to green stormwater infrastructure, it is more than $1 billion worth of investment that we can support. As in, these communities have enough money through the stormwater utility revenues to pay to the private financing guys should they were to actually engage in those sorts of deals. So a key, you know, a simple question would be, why is it that when we are discussing the Great Lakes Basin, I left out the states of New York, Pennsylvania, and Michigan? It is because these states don't really have that many stormwater utilities, and frankly, they are at a big disadvantage because they don't have stormwater utilities. In our project, we looked at, and I don't have time to discuss this, project delivery models and project financing models. The three types of project delivery models that we looked at are public-private partnerships, P3s, community-based public-private partnerships, which is a variation of P3s, which are just community-centered governance, and pay for success. These are technical sounding terms because they are. I gave you my business card to most of you. If you get in touch with me, I'll be very happy to actually share with you more details on these. There is also a flyer outside, actually a one pager that I brought with me. We also looked at public finance and private finance. When you actually engage in trying to assess how can we open the our way of thinking of reliance on public and public funds and public way procurements, perhaps there are newer ways in which you could lean on to market-based options that can offer solutions with the community at the center. This is a talk that I gave at, in Pittsburgh when they were trying to restructure their water utility. And the point we were trying to make is that through a community-based public-private partnerships, we could hit multiple goals, namely public health protection, regulatory compliance, financial stewardship, water quality and regulations. Green, many communities have green programs, infrastructure improvements, etc. I will go on to the recommendations that I have. Keep in mind that we have been engaged in this work in public-private partnership space, market-based options space, for the last 2.5 years. It is something that is quite common in transportation sector. It's just not very common in water infrastructure sector. So even though I personally think that there is a lot of promise, and we are currently in discussions with 5 different communities within the Great Lakes Basin that have an interest in actually going through an option similar to Prince George's County, still we have a long way to go because we're really beginning to kind of scratch the surface here. So I completely agree with 2 of Victoria's recommendations. The 3rd one I didn't include here simply because it wasn't really relevant to my work. The first was promote and coordinate the use of green stormwater infrastructure. I think it is very, very important, and there need to be some performance-based standards in place. The second is to leverage the WIFIA, Water Infrastructure Finance and Investment Act. I don't know who actually led this here, but it has been really, you know, I just saw the announcement that it resulted in the first $1 billion investments in 2 communities, actually. Incorporate, I think if you're thinking about WIFIA, my advice would be to consider priorities that lead to the use of green stormwater infrastructure. Perhaps there is a way to prioritize, give higher points if communities are using green stormwater infrastructure in their application packages. And as I mentioned, establish performance-based requirement for stormwater management. Fully fund clean water SRF. Even though much of the work that I'm trying to do is really in parallel with CW SRF, at the end of the day, because we are not far enough along the curve, as of now we have no choice but to rely on it. And in fact, one or two things that are really missing in the market-based options approach. One, for example, is, and I just don't really have time to go into technical detail of it, but when you do a pay-for-success-related project, where you're giving extra premium to a private financier for risking their money, somehow that guarantee needs to come from someplace which right now many communities are not very happy paying. Perhaps there is a very simple way to leverage the money, a very tiny amount of money that water, you know, state revolving loan funds give out, to connect those 2 dots. If you connect, talk with me afterwards, I can share that with you. Here are the people that are connected. Protection Fund has been the sponsor for the last couple of years. I think some of the work has become self-reliant, actually, because in the communities that we are working with, and developing business plans for, end up paying for their own business plans. As a consequence, they get confidentiality out of it, which is nice. ECT is my employer. I've been with them for 17 years. Corvius is the private partner in the Prince George's County. Nationally, there are only 2 community-based public-private partnerships. Both are being run by Corvius. There is only 1 community that, 2 communities that have stormwater credit trading. Both are being run by Encourage Capital, which is a New York City-based private equity company. And Quantified Ventures is the environmental impact bond company that is responsible for all 3 environmental impact bonds in the country today. So collectively, the 4 firms basically provide all the necessary know-how and public-private partnerships that we need. But here are my contacts information, although I think I've already shared my card with many of you. I recommend you to consider following us on Twitter. We have about 3,000 followers. Actually, it's one of the biggest following in the type of organizations across the Great Lakes Basin in our webpage. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Andrew. Next up, we have John Dickert. He serves as the president and CEO of the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative. His responsibilities include working with our 130 U.S. and Canadian mayors from across the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Basin to advance the protection and restoration of the Great Lakes. Before this position, John was a three-term mayor of Racine, Wisconsin.
Hi! How's everybody? These are the tough ones up here. They came in the front row. How's everybody doing? You all right? Okay. How many interns are you?
Any interns?
Intern in the 80s. Probably before you're all born. In staff?
Commercial staff.
Okay. All right. Good, good. I was a staff person in the 90s. So I've kind of been in that space with you and know that you're an important part of what you're doing out here, right? You've got to report to your congressperson. Hopefully give them some good ideas. So maybe we'll leave a takeaway with you today that you can then take back and have a conversation about. Okay. I also worked in the State House in Wisconsin. I was a mayor. I was in the private sector. I've done all that stuff. And now I work for an international NGO that helps to protect the Great Lakes. But we try to do something a little bit more than that. We try to bring this down to real level stuff. Okay, because oftentimes you folks are here and you're at a high level. You got a lot going on, there's a lot happening in your lives, and you're dealing with a lot that's probably kind of overwhelming like it was when I worked at Congress. You didn't have time to think about who's actually doing this. And are we making any sense with that, or are we just sending money now? So what I'm going to try to do is give you a little snippet of that. Okay? So first of all, this is my lake, this is my beach. I grew up on this beach. When I grew up, if you went swimming there, you came out with an earache. And you came out with an earache because there was so much contamination from the industries that you actually got sick. Now it is certified blue wave 15 years in a row. You can virtually just about drink the water right out of the lake. That's how pure it is. But it takes work to do that. So we're going to talk a little bit about this, but I just want to give you this idea. If you ever want to come to Racine, Wisconsin, this is my beach. It's awesome. Beautiful bay out there, great salmon fishing. You'll love it. And it's always 80 degrees every day. So let's go to the next slide. This is just an issue that we tend to forget about. 4 billion people do not have access to water. In Toledo, one day, the mayor had to turn off the water to 500,000 people. Can you imagine being that person that has to say, I'm sorry, but when you turn on your shower today, or if you're in the middle of shampooing your hair and the water stops? How upset do you think those folks are? Okay, they had to do that. That's what they had to do, because this is something we take for granted. It really is, because we're in America. This is great, right? It's easy. It's not. So let's get to the next slide. And I want you to think about these slides, not in the determination of colors, because we're going to run through this quick, okay? You going to be ready?
Yep.
This, water withdrawals. See the dark colors? Dark colors are bad. Go to the next one. This is population movement. Dark colors are where the population moved. The last sentence, census. Next one, water scarcity. Now go back all three and look at where they are. One, two, three. Back again to the front. One, two, three. They're all in the same areas, south and the west. In the last decade, the majority of the people in this country moved south and west, to the place where there's the least amount of water. But yet we still use water as if it's an incredibly abundant supply, because to us it is. But to the mayors and the people at the local level that are working on it, it's not. Because we have aquifers that are not in here that are drying up. And when the aquifers dry up, the recharge is 1,000 years. Now, I don't know about you guys, you look pretty good, but I'm not going to be here for 1,000 years. So we have to think about all that stuff, and it's happening at the local level. So what do we do to make this work? We look at how we take your level of thought, because you're dealing with the big money up here, right? You're dealing in the billions and trillions. States are dealing in the billions, and cities are dealing in millions, in thousands, and tens. So we try to think about this as to how do we help solve this problem. So let's look at one idea, and since these guys are closest, we're going to take it back to the people first. Mayors try to think out of the box. I've worked at all three levels, so I get the boxes pretty good. One of the infrastructure ideas that we've thought of, and this is something I've talked to the President's Cabinet about, as well as Speaker Ryan's office about. When you do a road, And I, by the way, I'm a parade artist. You'll find that out in a minute. When you do a road, this is the top of the road. Now, this is usually a little bit of cement or maybe some tar on top of that. And this is the end of the ground, right? Now, through here, you have your water. That's good. That's your clean water. Yummy. Then you have your wastewater. Well, you know what that is. Then you have your IT lines, cable, internet access, whatever it is. And then you also have your maybe your electricity's running through there as well, right? So you're putting all this under the ground for the most part. Unless you're in Florida. Where is anybody here from Florida? Anybody represent anybody here from Florida? Okay. The water's kind of coming up from the ground. So that's a problem. So they're moving all the electrical up. And that's in the sunny days, it's actually fun. So the biggest part of all this, when anybody wants to get access to this, is this right here. Because they gotta dig all that out, right? And that's really expensive. So companies hate that. So what we did is we developed a plan. Now this takes a little more time and a little more structure and a little more planning. But we tell the utilities, we're gonna redo this road. And the reason I draw this big, thick thing here is that we're going to do what they call a 20-year cap, and that's cement. So when you get done with that road, you're done for a city for 20 years. That 8 to 12 inches of cement should last you 20 years. Okay? So we're doing that, we call them that, hey, we're coming in. Well, normally, in cities like ours, we take care of the water and wastewater, so we got those lines taken care of. We call all these guys and tell them, yeah, you got to get in here. Why? Because we're tearing up the road. And they all go, woohoo! I don't have to pay for that? And then you go, yeah! And they say, awesome! Because they want to come in. Because they don't have to dig all of this up. And by the way, most laws allow them to do that whenever they want. So if you put this 20-year cap on it and they're not here, the next day they can cut into that if a line goes bad. That's where your taxpayers go, they get upset because they just paid for that road. So, they come in, the road's gone, they put everything in there. For every dollar that you spend on this, you save anywhere from $3 to $5. The only difference here, the federal government and the state government do not incentivize this. But a lot of cities are already doing this. So, then if you blend in the infrastructure, new lighting, bike pathways, blah, blah, blah. You start building that into this plan, you have an infrastructure that's being rebuilt for a third to a fifth of the total cost. But here's the kicker that your bosses are going to love, because everybody loves this. The businesses save money. The municipalities paying for it anyway. Because they're going in and redoing the road, and when they redo the road, they usually do this water and stormwater, right? So the private sector saves all money. So what we do, and what I'm asking you to do, is you have to go back to your bosses and you have to say, you know, I've got an idea. Because the reality is, I was elected official 4 times. As mayor and as a local elected official too, when I was 24. We don't always have the answers, but we look for the answers from smart people like you. So you go back and say, you know, maybe there's a way to not only build in this green infrastructure, but also to save money on this total infrastructure package. Your boss looks good, you look better, maybe you get a raise, God knows you need it. That's a joke, because I do know you need it. I know you guys are working for pennies on the dollar. Come on, I've been there. So, what I'm asking you to do is, as you are in these conversations with people, think about it from a different way. But then I'm going to ask you to do one thing for me, since I just gave you this great idea, and you don't even have to quote me on it. When you're sending the funding down, Victoria's right. Oftentimes, the federal funding comes down to the states then go to the local level to implement. If you want to see the largest percentage of that funding getting the most bang for the buck, you send it right to the city. Because the city's not going to take a percentage because they have to put it into the road. So if you get it direct, we call it direct send. Direct send, 100% of the money goes to doing the work. It's good administrative costs. So a couple things for you to think about, because and we're happy to do Q&A as we get done with this, but I think it's time, and I've been doing this for 35 years, I think it's time that we start thinking a little bit more about your generation, because you're the ones that are going to have to manage this changing infrastructure. And let me tell you, it's changing fast. But if you do it smart, you're going to have a better infrastructure. And really, isn't that what this is all about? Giving you a life that you can go, we did it right. So, something to think about. Okay? Thanks.
Thank you, John. Finally, we have last speaker, Gary Bill, tough act following a charismatic politician. He's the senior director of Clean Water Supply at American Rivers, an organization that works to protect and restore the nation's rivers. Gary works to promote green infrastructure in the U.S. by collaborating with a number of grassroots environmental organizations, business interests, as well as state, local, and federal agencies.
So I just got back from vacation for 3 weeks, which is how I think I ended up speaking after the politician, getting in that order. So, and also being the fourth person here, I'm going to try and make this as brief and get out of your hair as soon as possible. But I've been tasked with kind of presenting this from the nonprofit perspective of green infrastructure. And Victoria did a great job of describing what the problem is around stormwater, but I want to get into it a little bit more from an environmental perspective. My father hated the environment, and maybe hates a little strong, but he was from downtown Pittsburgh. And when you get down to this problem, it's really not just about water, green infrastructure, it's about how we're developing as cities, and as we're getting larger and larger. And my dad, being from the city, didn't really kind of understand nature that much. In fact, but he ended up being a teacher in very rural West Virginia. And one of the few things we could do together was go fishing the stream. So my dad, I don't think, understood the impact of these streams on downstream into the city, but he did understand the connection it had with the sun. So when I grew up, these were the types of streams that I got to play in until I was about 9. And this is a natural looking stream, you know, flat, even edges, lots of greenery. Then we moved to Washington, D.C., and when my dad got a job in the federal government, like many people who moved here. And this is what happens when you build and build and build. You get a lot of water concentrated in small parts. You get a lot of flooding like this. And then the new stream that I had in my backyard, and the new one, looked like this. So when you get large amounts of water all funneling into one place, you get this type of stream. Now, this is great. This looks horrible, right? But this also has practical ramifications for people. This undermines houses. It floods basements. It has massive implications for insurance. And that's where, actually, I like referencing this report by the Center for Neighborhood Protection. They're a frequent partner of ours. And they actually did a report in 2014 looking at insurance claims in Cook County, Illinois, which is the county that encompasses Chicago. They looked at insurance claims for flooding. And what they found is in Cook County, Illinois, the urban flooding is chronic and systemic. But one of the most interesting things that they found is that there's no correlation between damage payouts and the floodplains. And what does this mean? This means all the flood payments for damage were being done in places that you wouldn't normally expect a flood, like near a stream. They're all happening in urban areas due to pavement and water collecting there and flooding and damaging homes. And these claims were made across all income groups, but 67% of those zip codes, the highest concentrations of damage were due to people earning below the average median household income. So not only were we talking about urban damage and insurance claims, but now we're talking about it for the lowest and most marginalized communities. And so as a result of this, a lot of people were looking for innovative ways of dealing with the flooding problem. And they're still searching, but green infrastructure is probably the most promising out of all these innovations. Is it going to solve all the problems? No. But it is a critical component to this that I don't think we'll be able to solve it without it. And so in the Great Lakes in particular, you see Detroit, you see Cleveland, you see Buffalo, are all looking at green infrastructure initiatives, working with nonprofit partners, as a matter of fact, of coming up ways for implementing green infrastructure to solve these flooding problems, solve the sewage problems, in a way that is more cost-effective than what they currently have. I always like to highlight Milwaukee because I've done a lot of work there historically. And I want to point out that it's not just working in terms of just homes, but this is a picture actually of a public housing development that was developed by the City of Milwaukee's Public Housing Authority. And they were actually implementing green infrastructure because they have to think about 20 years out. They're not going to be able to sell these homes. They have to look at it as a long-term investment. And they started putting in green infrastructure in public housing because they see it as a way of protecting their investment and providing stronger community benefits for those people that have to live in public housing. Getting a little bit more into specifics, the city of Toledo used state revolving fund monies to build something called the Maywood Avenue Project. And this is referencing the state revolving fund program that Victoria mentioned earlier. This is one example of it. Back in 2008, they actually got green reserve funds. So within the state revolving fund program, there's a requirement for some of those funds to be used for green infrastructure, and they were actually able to use those funds to build this Maywood project in a very poor part of Toledo that really needed some investment. And I can't tell you the amount of people that came out, and not only did they really appreciate these being put in because it beautified the neighborhood, but they started putting in their own rain gardens to kind of match the aesthetic of this new solution. So not only are you solving a water problem, most of these communities were having sewage flooding, most of these houses were having sewage floods in their basements, and this solved the problem, and they liked it so much that they wanted to try and help accentuate it in their own backyards. And you can see also the difference in cost. Not only did this reduce the basement backups, but it was a fraction of the cost, $6.6 million as opposed to the $22 million that it would have been otherwise. And this is just a fun project, still in Toledo, called Hensville. Any of you baseball fans here? Well, there goes that joke. The local team in Toledo is called the Toledo Mud Hens, they're one of the most popular minor league baseball teams in the country, actually. And so we actually worked with them. They really wanted to accentuate the stuff that the city was doing on these green infrastructure efforts. So they actually installed, with some of our support, a fairly large green infrastructure site near the stadium to kind of educate the public about what's going on. And as you can see here, it's not just some butterflies, bees sorts of thing. It actually blends in with the environment. Not the best pictures, but they have trees, they have artificial turf for kids to play on, and then actually collects the water when it rains. So it's a really nice mixed-use area. And so this gets back to the recommendations made by made in the report, where from an environmental perspective, not only are we looking for environmental benefits, but we're also looking for public health and public community benefits. And we believe that the regulatory responses are not keeping pace with stormwater impacts as cities grow, or the emergence of green infrastructure as a solution. And so there's this increasing trend towards embracing decentralized green infrastructure in communities, but there needs to be more regulatory stability, certainty, and clarity out there. And so the recommendations in this report really get to that, and I think would be helpful to this. Furthermore, the Clean Water State Revolving Fund, and just funding in general, a lot of these municipalities are putting together local money. So 90% of water infrastructure is funded at the municipal level, 90%. And so actually, if you think about it, transportation infrastructure in this country, about a quarter of that transportation infrastructure is actually supported by the federal government. For water infrastructure, it's less than 5%. So when you think about that and what these municipalities are putting together to solve these problems, and they're already doing it, we owe it to them to provide the support to make it a more real solution. So that's where the state revolving fund is not going to solve all the problems, but is a really good foundation for them. And so it needs to be maintained and increased if possible. So I think my 10 minutes are up. I think I've made my point, so I'm not going to go on for much longer. But I would just kind of give you, paint the picture of what this means for the environment, what it means for communities, the costs associated with it, and just emphasize that municipalities are moving towards this, but they need support, and we need to make this a much more wider scale solution. So the report's great. We support it, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you, all the presenters. We'll open up the discussion now. Maybe I can start with a question, and then we can open up to the audience. I have a question to maybe all the presenters, and specifically Victoria. We know a lot about the gray infrastructure cost for building and maintaining. Do we know the same about green infrastructure in terms of maintaining it and how often it needs to be done? Are those costs built in when the community is designing them?
So there's a couple of questions there. Do we know what the costs are and are they built in or they're being designed?
Just keep it quiet.
So the costs, it depends. Some of them, the costs have been are known for some of the green infrastructure, and some of the costs vary. If you're going to install a bioswale on heavily clay soils and you have to use heavier equipment and go deeper for a bioswale versus really soft, loamy soils, you're going to have more labor and you're going to have to do more intense design specification. And this is outside of my specialty, but I know enough to know that not all design specs work in every situation equally. For a bioswale, for example, it's not a one size fits all. So the prices vary, but we are getting more and more information about the cost of these different. So you could get, there are studies that look at ranges of them. I don't have them at my fingertips. So the average cost for a green roof per square foot, or the average cost. So green roof, for example, you can have, they're built with trays, if any of you have experienced them. Some trays are 4 inches, some are 8 inches. Which trays were you putting them? Is there a slope on the building? Do you have to have, you know, support structures? So there's a lot of things that depend on the context of where it's being installed that will affect the price of it. But the information is out there, and you can get prices in your local community for what you're looking for. In terms of building in the O&M costs to them, that's been more uneven, and it's really a gap. We've found that, and talking to, we interviewed 41 practitioners and did 3 focus groups last year on this very topic, and we found that generally it's very difficult. The SRF funds are not able to be used for O&M, and that's something that we address in our report. I didn't go into that detail, but I'd encourage you to look at that. And that the O&M costs are not factored in as often as they should be. So that is an area that needs more attention.
I guess one of the questions that you have to ask yourself is, what do you want to accomplish? One of the things that we look at in Racine is that beach that I showed you collects about $5 million in revenue for us from tourists that come to that beach. 220,000 people go to that beach every year, and we get the tourism revenue of that. That means that we as a city have to grade and clean that beach every single day. We grade it because we get all the little pigeon poops and goose poops off of it so it doesn't contaminate the water. So there takes time and effort to keep that beach clean. But the $5 million in revenue that we get back from tourism, we think is worth it. The question is, do we want to have a clean beach? Do we want to have green infrastructure? Do we want to start preventing some of these things that are happening in our communities and around the planet that are happening? The mayors are dealing with this every day. It's not a question as whether it's happening. Toronto last year spent $8.5 million on climate-related incidents that it didn't have the year before. In Racine, an entire neighborhood of the beach washed away because of the impacts of higher water and higher storms. So the question is, what do you want to accomplish? And if green infrastructure is part of that, which helps to alleviate some of these problems, then you have to build it into your costs. But as a local community, the cities paid $300 billion last year alone just in water infrastructure. Just in water infrastructure. So if you want to have this type of a life, then you're going to have to pay for it. The question is, do you want to pay for it on the front end or the back end? So we look at this for, we go back to you and say, what do you want? As a citizen of this country and as a taxpayer of this country, what do you want to accomplish? And that's how we net value all of this.
I just want to point out the necessity to take into account the co-benefits that are associated with green infrastructure. So upfront costs are one thing. They can be lower for green infrastructure. Operation maintenance costs can be a little higher. But when you, oftentimes the co-benefits are taken into account. The Water Research Foundation right now is actually in the process of doing a report to looking at those co-benefits, and what they're finding is, while sometimes operation maintenance costs may be a little higher, it's usually because you're maintaining a space that's a more green space, so there's landscaping costs associated with it, and they don't take into account the co-benefits associated with the recreational value, the housing cost values, and things associated with that. So when you're thinking about just straight costs, you also have to think about the co-benefits associated with them. And the green roofs is a perfect example where it has water benefits, but many building owners are putting green roofs onto their buildings, not just because of the water benefits, but specifically because of the energy savings they get from it. And it actually makes the roof last twice as long as a conventional roof. So those often aren't factored in the cost. So when you're thinking about costs, you know, the straight costs are one thing, but make sure that you're considering co-benefits.
I just wanted to add two quick data points. I thought the other panelists did a great job actually addressing these. But in 2014, American Society of Landscape Architects carried out a survey of 450 projects where there was a gray solution proposed initially, and then the architects or the engineers, for one reason or the other, ended up using green infrastructure as a solution. In 49% of the cases, the green infrastructure solution that was adopted was cheaper than the gray solution that was proposed earlier. In 25% of the cases, there was roughly no appreciable difference between the costs. And in the remaining 25%, green infrastructure upfront costs were more expensive than the gray infrastructure. It's actually part of the report that I was referring to earlier about market sizing. So if you look at this single data point of 450 projects, you could say that in three-fourths of the instances, when you use green infrastructure, you're actually spending less money on a project. The second item that I wanted to actually mention to you is that, so those are projects, one project at a time, even where you're actually saving money. Then there have been studies, because you know these cities like New York City, the city of Milwaukee, they have very ambitious game plan for green infrastructure adoption. The Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewer District, which is the wastewater utility based around Milwaukee, intends to have 42,000 acres of green infrastructure by year 2035. That's called their year 2035 vision. And so they have already done these co-benefits, life cycle savings analysis. And in the report that I indicated earlier again, we carried out a quick survey on large-scale adoption of green infrastructure. And benefit to cost ratios basically range between 1.2 to 6 times multiplier on the cost that they were going to be getting. So if you include all the co-benefits that Gary was discussing, it becomes even more impressive.
We have one clarification. $300 billion was the water infrastructure needs for cities right now. $300 billion of water infrastructure needs.
Other questions?
This is an easy crowd. Come on, you guys can do better than that. It's got to be at least one there.
Hi, I'm Chad Ward of the Human and Water Critics Coalition. And so part of the solution to this problem is for cities to add fees to water bills. Is that an increasing trend in the Great Lakes, which I mean many Great Lakes cities have? And I'm also curious if you could talk about what that means for many of our Great Lakes cities, which also have a lot of low-income communities, and their ability to afford the water service.
I have the recorder, so I can perhaps go quickly. So nationally, there are about 1,550 stormwater. You can tell that I'm an engineer by training, right, because I'm quoting all these numbers. Nationally, there are about 1,550 stormwater utilities. And you know, they've come in all shapes and sizes, for cities that have less than 30,000 people to cities that have multi-million people living within them. The number of stormwater utilities across the country, not just within the Great Lakes Basin, typically has been increasing by 100 or so per year. So definitely there is a move to understand that, you know, the fees that you were discussing, you have to have dedicated revenues that you can actually leverage to actually address these. The challenge we have, at least in the state of Michigan, at least two of us are from the state of Michigan, is that there are some legal proceedings and precedents that is there that we cannot really overturn. And as a consequence, the state of Michigan has only 7 stormwater utilities. Did you want to address something else?
Yeah, that's called the Bolt decision, and we elaborate on a little bit in our report. So it's not, I think Sanjeev's hit it spot on. It's not impossible to set up a stormwater utility in the state of Michigan. It's just more difficult because of that. Because there was an argument over the fee versus the tax. So communities would do well to be very careful about how they structure in setting up this utility. But when you think about it, you have a utility that you pay electricity for. You know, we pay a utility for our gas, you know, and other things. So it depends on how the utilities are structured. Some states regulate those utilities, some don't. And we have a pretty well-entrenched system for wastewater, for example. But stormwater has been sort of like the orphan child of the water sector, if you will. We know how to manage drinking water and wastewater that comes in pipes, but stormwater just is being given more attention to because it's become more problematic because we really haven't had a system for dealing with it. So these stormwater utilities are definitely one way to do that. There are also offsets and crediting approaches that don't actually involve setting up a utility for communities that may not be politically have an appetite for setting up a separate utility. So there are a variety of approaches that communities can use. To your second part of your question, Chad, about how does that affect rates, that's a really good question because typically with water rates, like drinking water rates, if you have higher operation and maintenance needs to repair and improve it, what do? You increase your rates and then it passes on to the ratepayer, me and you, our bills go up. Well, when you have people with limited income, that can be a problem. So one of the things that's really nice is when you set up a utility, you can have an offset program. So I can keep my stormwater fee down by putting in rain gardens or putting in rain barrels or rainwater collection system. If I reduce the amount of purview, and I actually have one in the community where I live, so if I put stuff on my property to keep the rain where it falls on my property, my stormwater bill goes down. I don't think you can do that with your drinking water.
I guess one of the things that I would point out is that in the city of Racine, we have now just finished a study and we are incorporating a highway map for bicycles in the city. So certain streets are going to be designated, they're going to be plotted out, they're going to be all striped, blah, blah, blah. We did that because of people your age. They demanded it. If they were going to live in our city, they wanted a bike highway. So we created that. If you want to have a system where you're capturing, holding, and containing that water and using green infrastructure, then you're doing it for a reason. And you've heard a multitude of reasons why here. It saves money, it saves energy, it helps to stop disasters from happening. So if you want to build that into your future, then you've got to build that into your plan. Green infrastructure was always something talked about years ago that, that's pie in the sky stuff. It sounds good. It's all for tree huggers, right? But what we're finding is that that's not necessarily the case because we're finding dramatic results that it's not only saving money, but it's helping to capture water, cool buildings, and you go through the whole litany of things, right? The question is, do you want that? Because you can build anything into a platform. I built into my city a highway program for bikes. So if you want to do it, you can do it. The question is, do you want to build it into the platform that you're doing here? Because that's the most efficient way to do it, to make it part of the collection. You know, way before you guys were probably born, we were always saying, you know, we collect steel and it's awesome and we recycle steel and isn't that great? And then somebody said, we should recycle aluminum. And then, maybe we can recycle glass and all of it. Now what do? We recycle almost everything because the demand was there. Create the commodity, create the product, create the demand. So it's really, a lot of this is up to you. Do you want this as part of your system?
And there are some really interesting case studies around the country. You know, hopping a train, go to New York City, there's a neighborhood called Highland Park.
It is really impressive. It's basically abandoned, like 2 mile long stretch in Manhattan of rail lines that they have converted into a high density, green infrastructure setup. It's just a gorgeous area, and you can see all the buildings that are coming up right next to the rail line, which probably nobody wanted to go close to. That's what we are seeing in action. So it's not that it is something that is really sort of completely new and we are talking some space age stuff. It's already there. I think we just need to be more organized about how to go about doing it. I think this afternoon, you know, Victoria's talk with the report that GLC came up with, I think it very clearly and carefully outlines water infrastructure, financing gaps, regulatory drivers that are there, how do we go about actually making them more effective. And she has two or three recommendations. I think you brought one page of perhaps talking points that you can share with these guys. And the work that I am doing focuses, interestingly, almost the opposite of end of the spectrum because I am really focused on private financing and large-scale delivery. So not really focused on, clean water, state revolving loan funds. But the conclusions that we have are very similar. Because the work that I am doing is not really at a point where we are doing half of the water infrastructure delivery and financing is being done by private sector, it's just not there yet. We have no choice but to rely on this part of the pie and make it more effective. And I think the talking points that she gives you hopefully has some benefit to that. And then I think John and Gary basically spoke to sort of provide more color to the picture as well.
I want to address the low-income part of that question, because I think that's a real challenge that we're something we're really dealing with right now. Oftentimes, the stormwater is impacting, flooding and all that, are impacting communities that can least afford it, and then they're actually then burdened with increased rates to then pay for it, which is an injustice if you think about it. But if you talk to many of those people in those communities, they're willing to shoulder that if they can see improvements and the changes, but the engagement has to be there. There have to be programs there to allow that to be modified if necessary for those who really cannot afford it, because we're not just talking about some abstract increase in fees. In some cases, like in Detroit, people are having children removed from their homes because their rates are going up. That's in for water, then their water gets shut off, and then Child Protective Services come and take children out of the homes. And so that's a real life problem we have to think about when we're talking about this. So I think it needs to be paid for. That's where the federal government comes in and can help support, particularly in those communities that can't afford this. And there has to be proper engagement in those communities, with those communities, between any sort of municipality attempt to raise rates and how to do that in a fair and equitable way.
I guess I'll just add, to just sort of wrap up, I think some of the examples that we brought up, they look really great, but remember, if you were to look at some of those communities, I don't know about New York, but a few of the ones that Gary showed in the Northeast Ohio, they're doing some cool stuff, but remember, why are they doing it? They did it because they messed up first. And then they had to have a consent decree saying, uh-oh, you really blew it, now you're going to have to do this and you have to spend $42 million. And what the commission report that we released today, and I should say that it's not me, it's not my importance. We had an advisory committee that included representatives from communities, states, provinces, and the nonprofit sector, and private consultants that sat on our team for about 18 months looking at these policies and advising. So this is a collective effort. But there was one of the key recommendations is, let's be more proactive. We can do better. We don't have to just respond. And that response can be very costly, and studies do show that. So the planning and the getting up in front of this, knowing that, yes, this is what we want. Not only do we want to control volume, we want to control pollution. We don't want a public health crisis because sewers are backing up, or businesses have to close down, or children can't cross the street and get to their schools because the streets are flooded. So the there are studies that show that doing this up front can ultimately lower the costs and the fallout and the impact. So that's a key takeaway here.
Other question? Yes.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Mary. I'm from Côte d'Ivoire. Côte d'Ivoire is in Africa, west part of Africa. And I'm specialized in environmental law. So I'm really happy to be here because I wanted to understand what kind of infrastructure you can have here related to Great Lakes, etc. Because we have the same issue in Agri-Coast, floodings and invasive species too. So thank you, everybody. What I keep in mind is that how the infrastructure can benefit the community. I think this is the main idea. And I want to ask a question about invasive species. What are you doing? What kind of projects do you implement with invasive species?
Invasive species. Do you want to take that, Victoria?
So it's not really for today. So it is one of the biggest pressing issues in the Great Lakes, and I think that while green infrastructure isn't directly addressing it, there might be ways that filtration systems or bioretention systems can be addressed to manage stormwater, and where that is a conduit for conveying them. But it's a loose connection.
There are a lot of different conversations about different, we have over 180 invasive species that are present in the Great Lakes. So we're not going to eradicate them. Our strategy in the region is focused on prevention of new introductions and controlling the introductions that have made the Great Lakes their home. And there are, it's a whole nother conversation. I mean, the State Department on the U.S. side in collaboration with Canada spends millions of dollars every year just on one species, the sea lamprey. And then there's the invasive mussels and Phragmites and the round goby, and the list goes on and on and on. So there's a variety of different strategies that are being pursued at all levels of government, with also with the private sector and the nonprofit community. But that is an area where we have just a variety of strategies. So I'd be happy to talk to you afterward and dig in on that a little more.
But the invasive species, just in the Great Lakes region, we spend $500 million a year just holding invasives down. Now, that's a lot of money to spend just to keep something down. When you look at the fact that in the 1960s, when they found the first zebra and quagga mussels in Lake Michigan, and now there are over 15 trillion of them there, and they're literally sucking the lake dry of all the nutrients, we have a situation where our Great Lakes could die, because they're literally eating every ounce of nutrient out of the Great Lakes. Now, everybody would say, well, that's a problem for the Great Lakes, too bad. That problem is now quickly moving westward and is now going to have an impact on the Hoover Dam. So these are not issues that people, and listen, we fought back a bill recently to deregulate the shipping industry who comes in and dumps these very invasive species in our Great Lakes. These are issues that, when I said earlier that we've got to get up above about a 1,000-foot level and start looking at these things for what they are, we have to do that because they cost us money. And not only that, they may cost us the Great Lakes. You're looking at tens of billions of dollars in lost revenue if you don't have fishing industries, fishing boats, motors, you name it, because there's no fishing in the Great Lakes. We used to have a $4 billion a year industry in the state of Wisconsin for commercial fishing. It's $880 million now because of invasives and overfishing. So I'm asking you to think about this at a different level, because it's not just about whether it's cool or not. It's costing us money, and it's costing your future.
Thank you, John. I'm pleased to welcome Representative David Joyce from Ohio. He represents the 14th District of Ohio in the U.S. House of Representatives. He serves on the powerful House Appropriations Committee and the Committee's Interior and THUD subcommittees, and is co-chair of the Northeast Midwest Coalition, and is a great ally for all the work that we do. Congressman Joyce.
Good afternoon.
Thank God you got AC here, huh? Imagine what this town was like before they had it. Although it's probably better, people get out of town. And so you find that August is one of those times where it's always good to go home, because it gave me an opportunity to go down beyond the Great Lakes and see some of the great work that's being done on the GLRI and some of the money that we've been lucky to get appropriated to the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, and actually got to go on a boat and see some action and see some of the testing that's being done. And I do believe that we're making a pretty good comeback in some areas, but we do have some very bad issues as far as invasive species and this algal bloom issue. And we're not alone in that. I found that when I went down to the Everglades that they're dealing with the same issue now in South Florida. And it's something that's going to continue to be a problem. But you know, first of all, I just want to say that it's an honor to be the co-chair of the committee, and I give a shout out to my co-chair, Rick Nolan, Brother Nolan. His mother's a Joyce, so when he comes in here, you can give him the business too. But you know, it's a partnership with a guy like him that makes partnerships like this and partnerships that we have with the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative so important. You know, I said it once and I'll say it again, that the Great Lakes are not just a lake or a series of lakes. It's a national treasure and it needs to be treated as such. And time again, no matter who's in the Oval Office, we seem to have the same problem with making a priority on funding. President Obama had cut the funding to the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, and
I remember last year when President Trump, but we know it wasn't President Trump, it was Mick Mulvaney, who took the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative and cut it from $300 million to zero. And, you know, in some ways he did me a favor, because if he would have cut it a little bit, like I would tell people 10%, I might have had a harder time getting people to get back on board with us. But, you know, it was when you talk to people, then everybody got back on board. And this year, you know, Mick Mulvaney, he only heard the 10%, so this year they gave us $30 million instead of the $300. But we still managed to get it back to $300 million, because it's not, you know, my issue or a single issue. It's a bipartisan issue. It's a bicameral issue. And both the House and the Senate have found leaders throughout the buildings to help make sure that we continue to put this funding forward. And the importance of the funding is because I think it's a high watermark on how government should work. It's a combination of making governmental agencies work together with NGOs and share their information. Nobody owns the information. Everybody shares the information to make sure that we work on outcomes and solutions versus, you know, people holding up the information for themselves or trying to keep it to themselves. But, you know, one of the things that we had heard, and I'm proud to stand up for it, is also because, you know, when we had to, part of the argument was that I was getting it done through the Appropriations Committee and there wasn't any authorization. And we were lucky to get it authorized through WERDA last year with the Chairman Schuster. And the vote went through as 408-17. Now, rest assured, I got all those 17 names laminated. But, again, it was a matter of working with folks and explaining to them that how the money is used and how efficient it makes government and these NGOs and everybody working together. And the money is going to be spent. Let's make sure it's spent on something that is a high priority, as all of you can see it as. But, you know, and I don't do it just because I'm an avid fisherman or I enjoy boating. I do it because it's the right thing to do for our kids and for our grandkids. And let's face it, like many of you, it was just, as the story I came in on in the end, I mean, I tell people, if the Gajan carp make its way into Lake Erie, with the shallowest of the lakes, it's game, set, match. We don't recover. They'll tear up the environment there, and we'll lose all the investments we've made over the years. Then Governor Voinovich, and Senator Voinovich later, well, as his governor, was very influential as far as making sure that the fishing industry was tops. And not just because he was an avid fisherman, but because he understood that it also attracts tourism and creates instances for, you know, people to enjoy life out in the water. And one of the things we've had now with the fish in the, along the Grand River and many of the rivers, the tributaries to Lake Erie, is some of the greatest fishing around the world. You find people coming from all over. One of the other things I found out, which was tremendously interesting to me, because, you know, as much as I put bird seed out in the backyard because I like to see the birds come around and I like to hear them in the morning, we had 23 million people come to Ohio alone last year just for the watching the birds, because of the habitats that are also being created by restoring our wetlands and restoring some of the breakwalls and the other things that we're doing out on Lake Erie. And that's a boon not only to have those people from all over the world coming to northeastern Ohio, but also the fact that they stay in the B&Bs and, you know, they even drink the, it's not the best wine, it's good wine, but it's not the best wine in the country that's made in northeastern Ohio. It's a tremendous boon for the, you know, the economics of northeastern Ohio as well. But I understand, you know, today's discussion is about some of the green infrastructure things. And I got to tell you, the green infrastructure is a cost-effective approach to water management that, you know, it features some of the natural things in life, such as using and getting our rainwater and making sure that we separate that from, I know in the Cleveland area, it's been a big problem, is that the overflow went right into the same channels as the sewage was going into, and it was in a large rainstorm would push it all out in the lake. We need to stop that. It's not cost of, not necessarily cost efficient in the front of it, but it certainly is for the long term use of the lake, because when you build these large chambers to house the water, the rainwater, and then eventually leak it back into the lake, it's much more cost effective than allowing all the sewage and water, rainwater, to push out at the same time. And without green infrastructure, you know, our city's water management would be overwhelmed and results in flooding and, again, the release of raw sewage in there. But we need to continue to do the things we're doing along the lakefront. And some of the things we've done is with Great Lakes Restoration money, is changing the old-time farmlands, especially in the west or eastern end. The western end, unfortunately, we're working on. It's taking more time. But you know, in order to get the field in a way that the farmer could use it quicker, they tend to take the old snake-like stream and create a straight line. Well, that straight line in a big storm, instead of allowing the water to come up over the sides and rest in the fields, is now moving faster towards the lake, taking with it more sediment, taking with it also more pollutants, in that it's taking the phosphorus and the chemicals that have been put on the field and also out to the lake. So in the restoration process, we've gone back to taking, when you get some of the land, working with the Land Conservancy, is then going back and recreating the old snake-like creeks and creating wetlands, which are, you know, it sounds crazy, but they're nature's kidneys, that help clean up and purify that water, so the water that's going back out to the lake is what should be going back out, clean water versus loaded with toxic chemicals, potentially sewage and other problems. And our federal investment is one of those things that continues to make progress, and we continue to have funding, because when you have the Clean Water State Revolving Fund that we help invest in, it allows other groups and agencies to be able to participate in ways with good ideas, sharing the information, perhaps coming up with even better ideas, that we can ensure that we continue the lake to be clean and continue to do the works necessary to keep the phosphorus out of the lake area and hopefully stop creating the algal blooms and then choking off the western end of our lake. But I look forward to hearing some of the presentations today and then some of the things that have been going on that you've all been doing, because you're at the front and the cutting edge of what's taking place and doing those things that are necessary to continue to protect and preserve a national treasure. So I applaud you for your efforts today. I'm glad to help in any way we can. Please feel free anytime to reach out to our office, joyce.house.gov, and we look forward to being, as I'm called sometimes, on the floor of the Great Lakes guy, and I wear that with great pride, and I'm glad to answer to that as well, and glad to help any of you in any way we can. Thank you. God bless.
Thank you, Congressman, for coming over and speaking. Thank you all for coming to this event. We will have an email to all the attendees with the audio recording and the slides, and just email us with any questions you might have. There's some material up out front. Thank you.